So I will discuss connecting non-commutative geometry and the standard model. Standard model, by standard model, I mean the standard model of weak, strong, and force, weak, strong, and electromagnetic force. And I consider the standard model coupled to a non-standard gravitational background. And I will do this with a point of view, which is one, the one of spectral triples, this one. Okay, and I'll use then the object here. And okay, I will not discuss too much the reason to why I want to generalize geometry. To start with, there is an original non-commutative geometry, which is the phase space of quantum mechanics. The position and coordinates don't commute, and therefore I have a non-commutative geometry of the phase space. And however, if I know, where I know that there is a Planck scale, I will need some theory of gravity, and this indicates that also space-time may be some sort of non-commutative geometry. This can be the beginning of not another seminar, but another series of seminars, of course, but I will assume that you are open to the idea that changing the geometry of space-time is a necessity for physics rather other than an interesting mathematical thing. In this seminar, non-commutative geometry is not or not only the most common one, which is the one given by the commutator of x mu and x nu being a constant that Seiberg and Witten made famous and that gives lead to the Moyal product and all these things. So for me, this, I'm much more general in some extent and much less general because I will still have coordinates at the end of the day. Okay, so let me start. So the starting point is Kohn's approach to the to geometry, and this is an approach to describe, to start with ordinary geometry, but in such a way, in such a strongly algebraically based way that I can generalize this to describe non-commutative geometries. There are three basic ingredients out and two less basic ingredients. I start with an algebra, which describes the topology of space-time. So I'll have an algebra, you know, as a set of vector space with two operations. The algebra for my talk, it will be associative, but Latham and Shan are doing interesting things generalizing this too. And will be commutative or not, as the case may be. Then I will realize this algebra as operators on the Hilbert space. Finite case, there will be matrices, and in the infinite case, there will be matrices anyways, infinite matrices, if the Hilbert weight is severable. And but this Hilbert space describes me the matter fields of the theory. The theory has some fermions on it, in general, there are fermions on particles on it, and they are described by the Hilbert space. And then the geometry, really, is described by this, what I call the Dirac operator. This is a generalization of the Dirac operator. In some examples, it doesn't look at all like a Dirac operator, but this carries all the information on the metric structure of the space and other crucial information about fermions, like masses of the fermions and mixing of the fermions. So this is the geometry. There are two more important objects. One is chirality, which is always present in the even dimensional case. I will be in four dimensions in a realistic situation. And one is charge conjugation, the operator J. All these five objects make what is called a spectral triple, that because three are more important than the other two, but all five are important. Now, the starting point really is quite old, immediately after World War. I think it's something which goes under the name of Gelfand-Naimak theorem, but there are more than one theorem. And they basically say that the category, but doesn't matter, commutative sister algebra and topological Hausdorff spaces are the same. Commutative, you know, C star is an algebra which has an operation which is like taking the Hermitian conjugate or the complex conjugate. And C star has to do with norms. This has, I will not go into details, but there are matrix algebras or C star algebra functions on a compact manifold with values in the complex are the relevant example. Those are the algebra. And in fact, if I have a C star, commutative C star algebra, this is always the algebra of continuous complex functions on some Hausdorff space. Hausdorff space is very basic. All I need is points and disjoint points, given two points to open disjoint sets. So it's a very basic thing. So what Kant wants to do and is doing, not himself, but pretty much himself, most of it himself, but other people, we are there helping, is the transcription in all the usual geometric objects, I'll show a couple of them, in a way which is purely algebraic. Why is that? Because the point here is that commutative sister algebra, this is dual to topological Hausdorff spaces, if the algebra is non-commutative, then I may not be able to describe it in like points. Think of quantum mechanics. I start with the ordinary phase space in classical mechanics. This is a normal manifold. And then I put a H bar in it. So everything becomes operators and I don't have points anymore. But I still have some sort of geometry. And in the commutative case, I can reconstruct the points of the space in more than one way. And in a non-commutative one, they may not work or they may not be the same. It depends on the example. And the geometric aspects are encoded by this Dirac operator. So as I said, there is this dictionary which is being built. For example, bundles are projective modules. Bundles are, I have a manifold and I have something on it, like algebra of a matrix algebra on it. And I can do this as modules, which is a purely algebraic concept. So everything which I do with points and tangents and parallel transport, etc., I translate in operations that I do with the algebra. Forms are like potentials, one, four, are commutators between the zero and elements of the algebra, and they are operators on this Hilbert space. So this is again, everything is operators. Distances between points are defined not as the minimum of the geodesic distance, but using the Dirac operator again, and there is all this dictionary. Why is that? Because the algebra is more robust than pointwise geometry, and it will survive when I do non-commutative geometry, namely when I do a non-commutative algebra. If I can translate all the concepts, I don't have to do anything. They are all there. And we'll see that the concept of manifold is the fundamental one. In fact, in the commutative case, I know what a manifold is. A manifold is something which has a differentiable structure. And okay, I have to cover it with charts. And it's like locally R to the power N somewhere, and I can define derivatives on it. So this is a manifold. And I, of course, the description in terms of non-commutative geometry is more complicated, but then I can generalize it. So I take Kohn as proven, and there are a list of conditions. They were called axioms until he himself proved that they were a theorem. And the conditions are purely algebraic. So they have to do with the algebra of functions on the manifold. They have to do with the Dirac operator. The Dirac operator is a very powerful object. It's gamma mu d mu, but gamma mu in Kurth space is a very powerful object because it knows about the metric. It knows much more than the metric. And okay, so there are a number of conditions that tell me that something is a manifold, and these conditions purely algebraic, so they remain valid in the non-commutative case, and they define a non-commutative manifold starting from an algebra, an Hilbert space, and a Dirac operator. Okay, this one I'm just flashing this because it will be another seminar to show why this has to do with being a manifold. But for example, if I look at the dimension of a manifold, the dimension of a manifold is has to do, given a point, in how many orthogonal ways I can move around. And I don't want to do it with points, but I can do it with the Dirac operator, because the eigenvalues of the Dirac operator grow, the momentum grows, and they, okay, this is the compact case. The non-compact case can be done, is slightly more complicated. They grow, and by looking at the growth of the eigenvalues, which has nothing to do with the points, I know in how many dimensions they are. The fact that there is regularity, a real manifold means that there is a real structure, but I can transcribe it in commutations of elements of the algebra with this J operator. I will discuss it more in that. So everything there has nothing to do with the fact that there, well, has everything to do, but by looking at it, it's algebraic. So I didn't have to describe you the fact that there are points and a map to Rn. I look at globally at an algebra, I look at an operator, and I look at an Hilbert space. And everything, and if this is satisfied, then I can sit down and calmly produce the points, the topology of the points, and the differential structures of the points. And I can, of course, do, if you look at it, I need an operator, an algebra, and a Hilbert space. If the algebra is non-commutative, I can still do it. So I have a concept of a non-commutative manifold. This is it. Okay, now, this formalism is geared towards the construction of genuine non-commutative spaces. Masood here works on the non-commutative torus. This is really a non-commutative space. There is no space in the ordinary sense. It's a deformation of a torus. However, Kohn discovered that even if you look at almost commutative geometries, and I will describe what they are basically, there is an usual manifold underneath, and there is an algebra of matrices over it. So it's the real minimal generalization of the algebra of functions into complex numbers over a manifold. You just, instead of complex number, you take matrices. So there is still space-time. And so you can, for example, transcribe electrodynamics of an ordinary manifold using algebraic concept. So I have the algebra of functions, the Dirac operator, the Hilbert space, chirality and charge conjugation, and I can write down electromagnetism in the usual way. And of course, this seems a silly thing to do because I know very well what electromagnetism is. Why should I do all these things? But now I have a machinery that I can apply to other cases. And in fact, I can apply to the simplest case, which is even commutative. Now, I take, instead of functions valid in the complex number, I take functions valid into 2 by 2 diagonal matrices. So instead of valid into complex number, it's to 2 copies of the complex number. And this is, I know how to build electromagnetism. I have no time because I want to go to get to the standard modeling, but I know what to do, and I just, it's cranking a machine. I write down an action, a potential and everything. If I do this, I discover that the action which I get is the action of a U1 cross U1 theory, because this is like the map, instead of having one copy of space-time, I have two copies, because instead of having values into functions with values in two copies of space-time, and I write down, and I, so this is, I'm doing the electromagnetism, so the U1 gauge theory, so I'm doing a U1 cross U1 theory, but when I crank the machine with the Dirac operator, which makes the two copies talk to each other, the action is actually the action of a U1 cross U1 gauge theory breaking to U1. The Dirac operator makes the two as some off diagonal elements. They make the two copies of space-time talk with each other. And so there is, originally you have two photons. You have U1 cross U1, but then the two one on each copy of space-time. You can look at it as being left and right chirality, but then you have something which makes talk the two copies of space-time, and this is the Higgs field, and the action comes to be the usual Mexican hat phi to the fourth minus phi squared potential. So this started the study of almost commutative geometries, because in this case the space is only almost non-commutative, and there is an underlying space-time, and the internal non-commutative, there is an internal non-commutative space which is finite dimensional, so it's the simplest thing. So the algebra is, here a parenthesis is missing, is the algebra of functions on R4. Okay, I will be Euclidean, like when I do field theories. To be non-Euclidean is not simple, so I'm not, so, so the algebra is the functions on R4 times a finite dimensional matrix algebra. Finite dimensional sister algebra is always a matrix algebra. Actually, it's always the matrix of n by n matrix or the quaternions. Okay. So what I do is to describe not only the geometry, but also the behavior of the fields and their coupling to the geometry of space-time. This is gravity. And I'm treating on equal footing the external geometry, which is space-time, and the inner one, because my construction is all completely algebraic. So I have algebraic things, and I make no difference between space-time and the internal thing. So the approach is based on the spectral action, and the Hilbert space, which I will use, if I have this algebra, I always represent it on an Hilbert space, and I take the fermion matter fields, and the Dirac operator, which I will choose, contains all information on the metrical space-time, because it contains gamma mu in a curved space-time. But will be an operator in this, is an operator on this matrix algebra, so contains all the masses, or the Yukawa coupling, the couplings, and the mixing of the fermions. So my Dirac operator is an object of this kind. This is the usual Dirac operator on curved space-time. This is gamma mu d mu, and this is the Levi-Civita connection on a Riemannian manifold. So this is what I would call a operator. But since I have a finite part, I take this, I multiply times the identity, then I add something. Okay, this gamma 5 is for technical reasons, I don't want to times a matrix. And this is a finite matrix which will contain the masses with mixings of the fermions. Then, as I usually do with the Dirac operator, I have a covariant Dirac operator, which is a fluctuation of this Dirac operator, and I define this to be not the flat because there is the curvature here, but the flat in the gauge sense Dirac operator plus the curvature, which is the potential. This will contain all the intermediate vector bosons, and this JAJ is because I want to act from the left and from the right on the fermions of the Hilbert space. So, J is the charge conjugation. So basically what I do is I act on this on particles, and now I then, in order to act on antiparticles, I exchange particles with antiparticles and act and I come back. So I have only the one Hilbert space. So, okay, the action is has to be spectral as well. I cannot, after having done all this, I cannot write integral over dx, and what is dx? What is it? Everything is spectral. So the action is something which has to do with the spectrum of the Dirac operator. So what is the equivalent of an integral? It's a trace, always. So I take a trace of, take the Dirac operator, I divide it by a scale. This is a dimensional quantity for a physicist, so I have to make it a dimensional, and I regularize it. Chi is a cutoff function, and the action is naturally quantum, because it has to be read in the renormalization flow sense. So chi is a cutoff function, which, for example, can be, and it will be according to the calculations are simpler in one case or the other, can be the characteristic function of the interval 0 to 1, so, or it can be an exponential, it can be any cutoff function. Two are the usual, the simple one. You just go up to an eigenvalue, and then you say, I forget the rest, or you just make it decrease. And that can be anything, but the calculations are simpler in those two cases, as you can imagine. This is the bosonic action, this is SB, and there is a standard fermionic action, which again needs to be regularized, and the regularization is done in the usual way, and obviously I will use the same cutoff. So if I regularize the Dirac operator, of course I have regularized this action as well. Okay. Now I will go to the, I will start discussing the standard model, and in the work, okay, this has undergo several refinement, the theory. So the version which is the last benchmark version is actually in a paper by Chamseddin, Kohn, and Marcolli, and everything is to be read in terms of the reorganization group flow. So I give the action at a certain energy, and then I run down to the energy in whichever way I'm doing the experiment. So what is this constant lambda? And this constant capital lambda is done considering as boundary condition for the running of the couplings. I still have to give you the details of the theory, but this is the point in which I calculate this. And when I do the standard model in a moment, this is the point in which the three coupling constants are equal. Now, this is not true. The three coupling constants for strong, weak, and electromagnetic interaction don't meet exactly at one point, but it's approximately true. It was believed to be true at the time of grand unified theory. It may still be true if there is supersymmetry. It may still be true if there is new physics between here and 10 to the... Okay, the meeting point is 10 is... Not being a point, there is an uncertainty. It goes between 10 to the 15, 10 to the 17 GeV, contains 10 to the 16. Now, I don't know whether you want to believe to the recent data of BSEP2, but it appears like there is an important point at 10 to the 16 in the cosmic background, but this not. Okay, the couplings are found via the denormalization flow, and the Yukawa coupling masses and mixings are taken as inputs. So I assume that I know what are the masses. Really, if there is an X, we don't really talk of masses, we talk of Yukawa couplings, and then the masses are this by the expectation value of the X. So I assume that I know all these quantities, And so they are my inputs, including the Kobayashi, the Gabibbo Kobayashi Maskawa mixing and everything. However, I do not need the parameters of the X. And therefore, I save on one parameter. So I put all the parameters of the quarks, but I don't put the parameters of the X. And therefore, I have a predictive power. And I will discuss this later on. Let me dwell a little bit on lambda. In this scheme is the theory in which the spectral action leads, and then I run to lower energies, and it's the natural cutoff of the theory. I'm telling that the Dirac operator, what counts of the Dirac operator are the eigenvalues up to that scale. What comes after it doesn't really matter because I have cut off. So it's natural to think that above this lambda, there will be a different theory. And in this case, you see that the unification of the three coupling constants, which at the time of grand unified theory was believed to be the beginning of a new gauge theory, here instead, it's the point in which something even more radical may happen. Also, the structure of space-time may be different. And okay, now there are two slides which are technical just to show you that things can be done. Spectral action is the sum of residues. I can do a Taylor expansion of it. I can write it like that. And then Seeley DeWitt calculated this for a general case of a generic Dirac operator. His heat kernel techniques, there is the book of Gilkey, and there is a manual for more for physicists of Vasilievich. So it's a, there are two slides in which I, well, two slides out of three or four pages calculations in which you, there is a standard technique. You can study and look at it, and there is an expansion, and I, it's an expansion in power of lambda, and you see that this is the spin connection. Here comes the curvatures. There is in here, there is also this beta is defined somewhere above, or maybe not, but this has to do with the gauge thing. So I have an expansion in which you can recognize the curvature. This E has to do with various objects, and there is also the gauge couplings into it. So it's just, so matter is just cranking of the machine. And now let me show you how you get the standard model. Standard model, you start, okay, it's a almost commutative geometry, and you start with a finite dimensional algebra, and the natural finite dimensional algebra is 3x3 matrices. The quaternions, the unitary of the quaternions are the RSU2, the unitary elements, and C. So the unitaries of this matrix is SU3 cross U1. The unitary of these algebras is quaternions, and the unitary of this algebra is U1 of electromagnetism. You lose one U1 when you impose that the connection is determinant 1. So the unitaries of the algebra is SU3. I'm sorry, this is an O plus that should have been just a times. So SU3 cross SU2 cross U1. This is the way to get the standard model. Now I have to represent the algebra as operators on the Hilbert space, which is also as a continuous and a finite part, and there are spinors of space-time, and then there is the internal indices, and I will discuss this very much in detail later on. And I have gradings, which gamma, I have a chirality operator, which is gamma 5 times an internal gamma. Everything is external and internal, and splits into left and right. So I have this. The J operator exchanges the two chirality and conjugates particles with antiparticles. So J transforms the left electron into the right positron, and so on. So this is the algebra. It's like the algebra acts on the right. So it's, since it interchanges the two, it's like instead of acting row by column, you act column by row, and this is acting, the matrix is acting on the other side. And now for this h-dimensional, this finite part of the Hilbert space, the algebra has two parts, the finite one and the infinite name. One, the finite part, I take the zoo of non-fermions. There are 92 degrees of freedom per generations, including the right-handed neutrinos, which are, well, relatively recent addition because the, I have been working on this even before the right-handed neutrinos, so this was 95 before. There is an overcounting. This will be very important because I take, for HF, I take all of the particles, and then I take the tensor product times tensors. No, I've written somewhere before, I had written Hilbert space H equals L2 of spinors on R4 times a finite dimensional space. So if I put all the particles here, I will put the electron and the positron here, but then if I multiply times the spinors, I'm overcounting, and I will have to project things out. Now, this is called fermion doubling. It's actually a quadrupling, but the projection has to be done for left particles don't create you a problem, only a factor, but left, right, you have to project out. So this will be important later on. Now, you are not finished. You have an algebra, you have an Hilbert space, you have to represent the algebra, and you do this. I am skipping millions of details. I will be here until Saturday. If you want all the details, I'm not sure the time will be sufficient until Saturdays. But on demand and given 2 minutes of concentrating, I'll be able to do more or less everything on a blackboard. So everything is worked. So I have to find a representation of the algebra. And I want to do it in such a way that this is a manifold. So I have to consider all these 7 conditions that I have written. So I, of course, I know what J is, I know what gamma is, and the Dirac operator and the elements of the algebra, they all have to have commutators of a certain kind. So you can manage to do it. It's not automatic, it's not easy in particular, does not work for all gauge theories. If I were to try to do SU5, for example, or SO10, it will not work. For example, one strong restriction is that I am looking at representations of the algebra, not, and the gauge group is the unitary elements of this algebra. Now, the algebra has very few representations. So if I take SU5, they are the unitary elements of the algebra of 5x5 matrices. And this has only one representation as algebra, because you have to sum the elements as well. While SU5, as we know, has infinite representations. And if you want to do SU5, the old SU5 grand unified theory, you need to put the fermions into a 5, into a 5 bar and a 10 representation. The 10 representation of the group is not a representation of the algebra. So it works for the standard model, but it doesn't work for many more things. And we'll see that actually the interesting cases in which it works are, there are, but they are larger. Now, one has to crank the machine. So one has to go to this heat kernel and write everything down. And it's just a cranking of the machine. So what are my data? Are the particles that I know? Are the I have a curved background, and I have the standard model. I've chosen the algebra. That's all. You crank the machine. Cranking the machine is always easier to say than to do. So this is taken. I didn't even have time, or I wanted to just type it into LaTeX. I just took the picture of the paper of Chamseddin, Kohn and Mercolli, and you cannot really see it very much, but this is all of the terms in gory detail of the standard model, so a gauge theory of SU3, cross SU2, cross U1, coupled non-minimally to gravity. So if I put the space-time, space-time metric to zero, this becomes slightly shorter, and then I have all of the couplings of the right ones. The coupling of the fermions among themselves, I have the three vector bosons, intermediate vector bosons, and the coupling with the Higgs and everything. So this is the Lagrangian of the standard model in its gory detail after expanding it. There is a bit of scene. I can write it in a simpler way, but you get it. Of course, I started that I wanted to get it. So I'm not saying that I'm predicting the standard model. I have chosen a non-commutative geometry such that I could get this. No. Actually, there is a bit of scene that Ali, Alain, and Mathilde did, and that I do. You can split it into blocks. And there is some repetitions in the sense that you see now there is W mu nu sometimes, and there are three intermediate vector bosons that are W, B, and G. And they give the same thing. Once you calculate it for one, then you can repeat it. There are some couplings, so I can making it more schematic. It can be done, and has been done by. Okay, this is an evolution of the one of Chamseddin and Kohn spectral action, the original one. Not many people. I think the people in Marseille, in Naples, and Ali and Alain have done it. I'm not sure how many have done. I think Vasilievich in Sao Paulo has done it. There is a sufficient number of people to say that you trust it. But this is the standard model. I mean, if you sit down, you recognize the standard model, really. And So this calculation is not done by symbolic things. Other ones that we did and Lee did are done by computer because then the matrices become bigger. And okay, so as I say that the data are relative to fermions, but there is no information on the X mass, really on the expectation value and the quartic coupling coefficient. And they can be calculated from the fermion mass, one of them you need. And really, okay, fermion masses are really the top quark Yukawa coupling. It's a function of all of them, but it's dominated by it. So it really depends on the... And so one has a prediction. This was a genuine prediction for the X mass. The prediction which was done was 170 GeV. This was excluded shortly after, before the calculations of the Higgs mass. It was excluded shortly afterward. And in any case, now we know that the mass is 126 GeV. Now, it depends on how you consider this theory. If you say that this is a mature, fully formed physical theory, then the result is wrong. And when the result is wrong, that's it. If you take, as I do, as a tool to investigate the standard model and to understand it based on mathematics, so whichever number I will find for some future, I am not saying that this is something which has to be confronted with experiments. I'm just understanding the theory. And so from this point of view, you start with a theory on pure mathematics, and then you get 170 GV. You could have gotten the average of the masses of all the particles, and which is much smaller, or a fraction of the mass of the electron, or whatever. And therefore, so this was as the theory stood before the experiment. Now there is the experiment, and then I'm understanding in which way to go. What are the ingredients that I wasn't using? So this is my point of view. Just on the issue of predictivity, compare with supersymmetry. Supersymmetry is wrong because we don't have a partner of every fermions and boson with the same mass. But people, okay, now it may be wrong, but it's 30 years after that is wrong, and many more people worked on it and understood that the point was the breaking. So I hope that it will not do the fate of supersymmetry if it's really true that there is no supersymmetry. Which, okay. So I will try to understand in this framework the origin of the standard model. Now I think that this is my seminar. I'll give a different seminar tomorrow at the University of Waterloo, where I will instead concentrate on the running of the coupling constants and this thing. So now this seminar, because of some connections that can be with the work on Latham and Shan, I will concentrate on the symmetries of the theory. So this is the standard model for me. Now I'll try to understand how this emerges and in which way from the most general algebra, which satisfies the conditions of being a non-commutative manifold. The conditions that I had written were purely algebraic. So they have to do with the algebra. So I can use it also in the finite dimensional case. It's just a matter of seeing which algebras of matrices satisfy this. Algebra of matrices are either matrices of complex numbers or matrices of quaternions. There are no other sister algebras, or real numbers. So those are the family of sister algebras. And I can, that is not difficult, it takes some time. It's in the Chamseddin, Kohn, and Marcoli realized that an algebra must be of this kind. Matrices of quaternions and matrices of complex numbers, so matrix of A times A quaternions and 2A times 2A complex numbers. Now, quaternions I can easily, the way to represent quaternions are with 2x2 matrices, and a quaternion is an object of this kind, A mu sigma mu with A real. So this is really 2A by 2A matrices here and 2A by 2A matrices here. But here there are some constraints. Okay, so this is the only algebras which are allowed. And this algebra acts on a finite dimensional space of dimensions 2 times 2A squared, or multiples of it, copies of it. Now, in order to have something which is non-trivial, that has at least a grading, left and right, A must be larger than or equal to 2. The smallest is M2 plus M4, and I need an Hilbert space of dimensions 32, this is the smallest one, for one generation. In all this scheme, for as much as I would like to, I cannot say anything about generations. Particles are replicated 3 times equally, and this is a mystery, and for the moment, I have nothing to say on that. Okay, so there is a grading condition. Sorry, this gamma must be small gamma, the chirality. It capitalized itself. And so I start with this algebra. Then this condition, which is one of the 7 conditions, immediately lowers this to HL times N. And then there is another order one condition. All those are the conditions that I had there, which I'm implementing one by one. And the smallest algebra, which I can get, which is chiral, so it does chirality, and implements all the conditions, is actually the standard model. Okay? Now, one can discuss on the importance of this, because why should it be a manifold? But now let's look at the physics. Okay, here you might have recognized a patisalam sort of object, SU2 cross SU2 cross SU4. Now, a patisalam has a field which breaks the SU2 cross SU2 down to U1. And this field, which I will call sigma, can in fact appear in the Dirac operator, Chamsetdien Kohn put it by hand, in the position which corresponds to neutrino Majorana masses. Now you can crank the machine again. Well, actually you can see the terms which are the extra terms. You crank it, you can do the extra little cranking. And so this field will change the runnings of all the quantities from the, and you get, but you have another parameter, of course. But now you lose prediction, but, or your predictions are much less stringent than before, and you make the X mass compatible with the experimental value. So physics is telling me that in this framework, right-handed neutrinos and Majorana masses are crucial. How much time do I have considering injury time that I started? 10 minutes are sufficient. 10, okay, then I, okay. So basically, the physics, that's what I said, I get an input. So physics is telling me that I have to look at Majorana masses. Right-handed neutrinos are important. Without this input, I will get the wrong mass. Okay, now I am getting slightly technical, but let me, I will, so what is a vector in this huge Hilbert space? It's a spinor with lots of indices. Well, first of all, there are the fact that this is a spinor in space-time, okay? So the spinor mu, I will split into S and S dot. If you are old and if you looked at, the, for example, studied field theory on the original paper, what is Schwinger, or you can, there is a notation in which take gamma mu and you write it like S, S dot. And this is, they take two values and together they make the, because the spinor is a Dirac spinor, is twice a Weyl spinor. So there is an index for the Weyl spinor and another one. They're called S and S dot. So the a spinor in this field is something of this kind. Now there are 384 dimensions because it's 3 times the 96 times 4. And this is 384. This has been checked by more than one calculation. And I can look at it as spinors times this internal space of, say, 96 for one generation, or I can look at spinors by something like, I put all of the indices together. Okay, so I have two indices. Those are the space-time indices. Then I have an index, which is the leptocolor index. So the one which is 1, 2, and 3 for color and 0 for the zeroth color, which is the lepto number. Then I have a flavor index, which runs from 1 to 4. This is electron, it's split into two, no? Electron, right electron, left electron, right neutrino, and left neutrinos. Then I have an index which tells me whether I have a particle or an antiparticle. And then I have an index which tells me which generation I have. So this is all these indices. The colors are important. If you're colorblind, you might have a problem. I can give the explicit algebra representation in terms of those indices. How does it work? Okay, the Dirac operator and the gamma matrices act on, they have an index and they act on this. Then I have the quaternions and they act on the blue indices. The quaternions have to do with weak theory, the SU2. So they act on the spin, on the flavor index. And then I have the complex matrices, this 4x4 that then breaks to SU3 cross U1, which act on this. The U1 acts a little bit on this and a little bit on the other one and make this. So this is for the algebra M2, the big one, M2, MA of quaternions, M2A of complex numbers. And then I can, I am flashing this, but I can write down the Dirac operator, and this is a 96 by 96, but I make it in block. In this sense, the calculation is not so difficult because I do it in blocks and I recognize the various bits. They contain the Dirac Yukawa particles, and notice that here there is left and right, and they connect left with right. They connect left with right here, and this has to do with the Majorana masses, and they connect right with right. And then I write down all these things, and I'm going fast on this. Okay, we know the rules. We can build the one form, which are fluctuations, and you crank the machine. But then you run into a problem. You run into a problem because you don't find this sigma, this field sigma, because of the position of the right-handed things. What do you do? Well, one way is to violate the first order condition. So this is the commutativity of functions and potentials. So this is one way, and this was chosen by Chamsuddin Kohn and Van Suylenkom, and I have no time to discuss with it. I knew that I had no time. Or there is another way, which is to look for a bigger algebra, always reminding that it's a manifold. So this is the algebra for manifolds, and I can consider the case when A equals 4. When A was 2, I had the standard model. Now I consider A equals 4. I couldn't find anything interesting for A equals 3. Now I need 128-dimensional space. And for three generations, I find again this 384. So I can represent this larger algebra, which I call the grand algebra, on the same Hilbert space. And I need to find a representation of this algebra on the Hilbert space, which satisfies all of the conditions. Now, again, I will not go into the detail. I can actually go into even more gory detail than what I did before, but I can do it. But what is the point is that I have the algebra has two pieces. One is this quaternions, which has the weak force. And these are the complex number. This is the strong force. And in order to do the representation, I have to have them acting on different indices. Otherwise, they don't commute. And now what do? I put together this leptocolor index with one of the indices of the spinors and the flavor index with the other index. So I am mixing together, and in this way, for those that know it, I am avoiding the Kalman-Mandula theorem otherwise, because I am breaking the Lorentz symmetry. I'm putting the Lorentz symmetry, a part of it acting with color, and a part of it acting with flavor. So I am in a phase in which the Euclidean structure of space-time, or the Lorentz after weak rotation, has not emerged. The fermions are not there yet. I'm in a pre-geometric phase. And so I I can envisage this grand symmetry to belong to a pre-geometric phase, and the elements of DF are small because I am at very high energy, and I only need the Dirac operator, this Lash, and something which breaks the symmetry down. It's pre-geometric because I don't have I have the topology of space-time, but I don't have the Lorentz structure of space-time. I don't have it yet because it's mixed up with the gauge, with the gauge degrees of freedom. So I'm breaking Lorentz because Lorentz is together with the gauge group, but not in the way that you want. No, everything is okay. First order and zeroth order are there. There is one problem, is that the problem that we have is that there is no bounded operators when I take the commutator. I would like to have the Dirac operator with the algebra to have at least a dense algebra, which is, and that we don't, because we have the derivatives in it. Something of this kind, but I don't have a name. I'll have to invent a name for this. But I want to say, I want to finish by saying what is the added bonus. And the added bonus is that there is a Dirac operator, is larger. I have more room to operate. And the Hilbert space is the same. I have abandoned the factorization of internal indices, and I can now accommodate the Majorana mass. In this larger algebra, I can put the Majorana mass, and I can satisfy the order one condition. So this is the difference with the work of Shamseddin, Kohn, and Van Suleco. They abandon order one. We keep order one, but we enlarge the geometry. The two papers, by the way, came out basically at the same time. Our paper appeared a bit 2 weeks before, and our referee was more bothersome than theirs, so it was published a couple of weeks afterwards. But they appear at the same time, and probably they are not really in contradictions. They can be, because their violation is sophisticated, and this is not just violating. Okay, just to finish, so we have to abandon this. I would say the bounds of the commutator of the algebra with the Dirac operator. The original algebra is still bounded operator. The natural scale is above a transition that gives this gives you. Now, how high is the scale? We can discuss, because it's more 10 to the 16 is a bit on the low side. Okay, one final thing is that the grand symmetry is not ordinary gauge symmetry. There is no SU8 in the game because everything gets mixed. And it represents a phase in which the things are together. And the differentiation comes as a breaking of the symmetry, so which is triggered by sigma. So this sigma not only breaks the gauge symmetry, but it makes somehow collapse this pre-geometric phase to a free. So what sort of space-time is this before in this grand symmetry, what we have? Okay, now this is not just because you invited me, but I think that the structure that we have above, we should be very radical. So probably some non-associative structures can be of interest, but now the challenge is, there are two challenges. One is to go down, because cranking the machine is never finished, because then you have to understand all these terms, how they actually do. I have a student now that basically works on the running, the flow, and really understanding what are the quote-unquote predictions, I mean, what are the consequences for phenomenological consequences, taking into mind that they are not yet predictions, and on the other side, and this is what probably we would like to discuss in this week, is what can be there into higher symmetry above or at this scale. And I think this is the right moment to finish. Thank you.
Thank you. is this SU, this is not the grand symmetry,
right?
You said something about SU5 mounting.
Yeah, SU5 doesn't work. SU8 wouldn't work either, because. I cannot. Grand unified theory don't work because I don't have an algebra. The big constraint is that I have to have an algebra acting on the Hilbert space. Right. Now, I can have everything or nearly everything work if I enlarge the Hilbert space. So if I put more particles, but then that's not SU5, because SU5 is the particle that we know arranged in two representations. Or SO10 doesn't work. So I have a Patissalam, but I don't have SO10, because SO10 I would have to have real 10 by 10 matrices, and they don't come into this scheme. So the grand unified theory with a bigger group, bigger gauge group, basically don't work. So it's a different. So when I talk of this M8 symmetry, it is there is no SU8. I mean, it's a symmetry which mixes together half of the Lorentz indices with leptocolor. So it's a complicated. I don't know how complicated, but it's not that one. Otherwise, in this game here, I would run into problems with Kalman-Mandula because I'm doing gauge theories with. Yes.
So as you mentioned in Kahn's finite Dirac operator,
mm-hmm.
he has these non-zero components mm-hmm. corresponding to the that will eventually correspond to the right give rise to the neutrino masses.
Okay, now I can.
And like you say, they kind of put in by hand the field sigma in their model. Mm. You're getting it here by an actual fluctuation.
No, I'm putting it by hand.
Oh, you are.
The only work that says why should be, you know, these three zeros, why they have to be zero, the only work that says something in this respect is your work. The Dirac operator here is an input. So I say, okay, I know what the particles are.
You're
I know the masses.
You're setting those guys to zero by hand.
But by hand, yes.
Whereas normally you would predict that the mass of the right-handed neutrino is constant.
Mm-hmm.
They fluctuate. They
that
space time fluctuating.
Yes. No, that I have.
Not by fluctuating.
No, that I have because.
Okay. Have you get one? Do you genuinely get by the fluctuation procedure one scalar field sigma, or do you get a matrix?
It depends how many terms I put there. I put only one element different from zero, and therefore I get one field. If I were to put the other ones, then I would get, I don't remember if there is a comment in the paper or not, but this is the sort of the minimal. So I could put I put a right-handed, I come up with a seesaw mechanism, and I do it for right-handed neutrinos. I could, in principle, do it for every particle, and I would have a plethora of these fields. Everything will come out of the seesaw. So my idea, and that's why I'm actually interested in your work. My idea is that there is one which is different from zero, and this becomes the neutrino. Okay, the three generations have nothing to say. So I think in terms of one generation. So. I have a Dirac operator at a very high energy, at a very high scale, which has one eigenvalue which is way bigger than the other ones. Okay, this fixes with the particle which we call the neutrino. And then there are some other terms which are much smaller. There is much, much smaller because we have a hierarchy problem because between the top mass and the bottom mass, there is the factor of 30, but between the electron mass and the neutrino mass, there is a much bigger gap, and actually I have to do it with the seesaw mechanism. If anything, there is a problem because the seesaw, I would like the big mass, right-handed mass to be even bigger than it usually thought. Usually it's thought to be a few times the top mass. For me, if it's a few orders of magnitude bigger, it's even more natural. But in any case, there is one big mass which gives one particle which has the seesaw, so gives one particle which splits into very high mass and very, very low mass, and gives you this field sigma. This I can do. And if you cannot do it with the smaller one, because you just don't have room in that thing. If you put it there, like, as I said, you do the commutator and this field disappears. So either you violate the other one or you go to a bigger thing.
All right, well, in view of time, let's thank you.
Okay.
Again.